This is the Extraordinary Science Radio Hour. Hello, everybody. This is J.W. McGinnis, president of the International Tesla Society, and your host for the next hour as we interview some of the most fascinating and creative people in the world today. We've got a great guest lined up for this evening, and I do want you folks to right now get your pen and pencil out, or paper out, pen, pencil, or paper. Let's try to get all three. And be sure and write down these numbers, because it's very difficult for us. In fact, we cannot stop. We're just too understaffed to give out these phone numbers. So you got to write them down while you're listening to the show, okay? And these phone numbers will be given to you periodically throughout this interview. And I know that there's a lot of things that you're going to want to question about, and as well as get the book. So let me introduce my guest for this evening, Dr. Paul LaViolette. And Dr. LaViolette has written several books, and this latest one is one that will give you something to think about. Well, I found it to be very illuminating, and it does explain some correlations between the metaphysical, so to speak, as well as the physical. Now, when we're talking to scientists, you know, they don't like to get into that area at all. Actually, when I say metaphysical, I'm talking about the ancient forms of science and, you know, the yin-yang and, well, we're going to get into a lot of that stuff, but I just don't want to hold up any longer. I want to introduce my guest, Dr. Paul LaViolette, author of Beyond the Big Bang, the latest book that he has produced. And Paul, first off, the book will leave you contemplating for some time, but I think it was very incisive, the way that you are coupling some of the, well, for lack of a better word, do I dare use myth, with modern science.
Yeah, not only the ancient creation myths, but also lores like the Tarot, astrology, the I Ching, metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've done this. The way you have compiled this book is very well organized. And I'd like to ask you, I mean, this wasn't something that you wrote overnight. You spent an awful lot of time in research and development.
Many years. See, actually, the connection with the ancient myths and lores began, I started seeing those connections in 1975, so that's what, 21 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a certain perspective that I developed before that, so you could even go back further to see that what we have here is really a major discovery, that myths symbolically encode concepts that we've just discovered recently. This completely changes our whole perspective of past civilizations or what's being handed down to us.
Yeah.
And raises questions like, where did it come from? Was it developed on Earth, or do we have contact with extraterrestrials?
Right.
These are makes you wonder. Before we were talking more like people making carvings on sticks for keeping track of the moon cycles, and this just brings you a quantum jump to a totally different perspective of what ancients understood, even beyond knowing pi to three or four significant figures, which Scholar de Lubeck talks about in some of his work.
Yeah. They're basic to understanding, every type of mathematics system that's ever been developed. And when you're dealing with these types of equations, and then the way that you you're tying in with what would you say when they're talking Big Bang? That is what modern science has unofficially said. This is how it all began.
Yeah.
Do you see any conflict with that and the religious organizations that are looking more creationism, and would this here really be a departure from creationism?
You find that some creationists back the Big Bang concept. For them, the Big Bang, they can visualize the important aspects happening in 6 days, like it says in the Bible.
Yeah.
I've met people who find that fitting well. Now, interestingly, Genesis is related to some of the other ancient creation myths. There's similar symbolisms that you find in the Babylonian creation myth, for example, also in the Egyptian Osirian creation myth. And you can interpret Genesis differently, actually, that it was meant symbolically to be taken rather than literally.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's talking about actual processes that were going on before physical creation began. And that the separation of heaven and earth, rather than to think in cosmic terms I don't know how you picture that, but that this was actually the formation of a subatomic particle. That really, by taking these myths and even Genesis literally, we degrade the brilliance of what's there.
Mm-hmm.
That whoever developed these metaphors understood things that we've just discovered. For example, how does order emerge in a non-equilibrium system? Now, this is these are concepts that we've begun to study in this century.
Yeah.
It leads to this ancient view of creation, leads to more of a continuous creation rather than a big explosion and happening all at once like in a Big Bang.
Yeah.
So it's something that would have gone on for billions and billions of years, maybe even trillion years,
mm-hmm.
where matter creates more matter. It's more organic view. And you don't have a whole bunch of energy coming into creation all at once. It's on a much smaller scale. You're describing the miracle of how a single particle emerges from the ether.
Mm-hmm.
The ancients viewed that space was filled with ether,
mm-hmm.
but not a mechanical or dead ether like we were visualizing last century,
mm-hmm.
Western ether theorists,
mm-hmm.
more like the Chinese concept of yin-yang, where the ether is dynamic and it's transmuting, it's more alchemic.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, yin-yang metaphysics is a type of alchemic metaphysics.
Okay.
And so you have process going on, and process becomes the basis of the physical world.
My guest is Dr. Paul LaViolette, and we're talking about his latest book, Beyond the Big Bang. And we're going to get back with Dr. LaViolette in just a moment, but I do want to remind you folks that are listening that this program is being brought to you by the International Tesla Society, the world's largest and fastest growing independent science organization, an organization that cares about you and an organization that wants to make this a better place to live. No matter what the science is, be it in medicine or if it's in physics or if it's in energy or the environment, whatever it is, when we see something out there that isn't adding up, we're going to let you know about it. And of course, when we see somebody that is producing something and is beneficial to mankind, we're going to be out there promoting them. You can be sure of that. Science is almost at a standstill in many areas, and we want to give it a good old kick in the butt and get it going so that we can really address some of the major problems that are confronting us. As it is right now, we're gagging on the water, we're choking on the air. I don't know how much time is left, but we need a drastic turnaround, and your membership really helps that because it allows us to seek out those people that have the answers. And we want these answers brought to you in the form of our demonstrations at the Extraordinary Science Conferences or the Tesla Symposiums. We want the articles in our magazine. Our magazine is absolutely the best science magazine there is anywhere. And by the way, folks, after this next issue, we are renaming the magazine. We're going right back to basics. We're going back to Tesla. Now, we've called the magazine Extraordinary Science, and we've done this for years. But we want to get right back to the grassroots, and so the new magazine will be called Tesla, a Journal of Modern Science. And it's going to continue to have all of the exciting stories. It'll continue to have all of those innovators in there with their stories or with their devices, how they work, how can you build one. What is a cure for cancer? What is going on out there in that field? What about these amalgam fillings? What about fluoridizing, fluoridation of our water? What about these immunization shots? What we try to do is to get the other side of the story to you and sometimes point out the folly of some of the stuff that is being jammed down our throat by these medical communities that are often run by the pharmaceuticals and other moneyed interests. We want what's best for you, and we seek it out, and we try to inform you of what is going on, and always try to give you that other perspective. And, of course, I can't say enough, we try to promote those people that are doing good things, and we put them on our radio programs, we publish their articles, we have them at our conferences, and, folks, there is a platoon of them out there right now. May not sound like a lot, but there's a platoon out there right now, and they are coming up with some fascinating breakthroughs, and you'll be reading about them in the Extraordinary Science magazine, soon to be called Tesla. But at any rate, you cannot get this information anywhere else. So why don't you be a member today? You get the magazine. You'll also get our newsletter, which tells you what's going on within the realms of the society, the activities of our ham net, and so forth, as well as our, well, let's see, what have I left out? Well, the continual literature updates, as well as our resource guide, which is 132 pages, with just hundreds and hundreds of books in all areas of science. We want you to know, and we want you to be informed, and we want to make a difference, and you can help us make that difference by becoming a member. Again, it's just $30 a year. You can join, have your credit card ready, and give us a call at 800-397-0137. The number again, 800-397-0137. Now, folks, I want you to go out right now and get your pen and paper, get your pencil and paper, because we're going to be giving out a number here so you can get this book that we've been talking about with Dr. LaViolette. It's called Beyond the Big Bang, and it has a lot of information in there. Dr. LaViolette, tell me somewhat of the, well, I've heard it since I was in grade school, the riddle of the Sphinx. What's going on there? What are they trying to, you know, tell us?
Well, when you approach the Sphinx symbolism from the standpoint of having understood this creation science, it's encoded, you begin to understand what its significance was. Now, the Sphinx is traditionally, in astrology, is considered to be made from the animals representing the four fixed signs of the zodiac. You have the bull, Taurus, the lion, Leo, Scorpio, in this case, as the eagle with the wings mm-hmm. instead of the scorpion form, and Aquarius, which the man or in some cases the female head, like in the Greek Sphinx.
Mm-hmm.
And you realize that the Sphinx is really a key to deciphering a cryptogram. Now, this is an entirely new concept, which I discuss in my book. The way I came to this realization was, first, I saw the connection between the Tarot and this modern science, that the Tarot arcana, the first 10 major arcana, which are pictograms believed to have descended from ancient Egyptian times, that they represented the frescoes in the initiation chamber where the priests were brought in and initiated into the Osirian mysteries, Osiris being the there's a myth involving Osiris, which mm-hmm. Actually depicts the creation of the world in symbolic form.
Yeah.
And having seen this in the Tarot, and I was told that there was a connection between Tarot and astrology, and that both Tarot and astrology were reputed to encode advanced science, but that it had somehow been lost. looked at the details of what it really all meant somehow become lost through time. And having seen this connection where the science of creation was spelled out so clearly in the Tarot in the right order, you know, coming up to explain the creation of a subatomic particle from a reactive medium undergoing transmutating processes. I can talk more about it later.
Well, in detail. Okay, what I'm seeing here, and what I'm grasping is we have a dynamic. There's a dynamic, and it gets into the dimensional phase. As an example, you know, you can't have a hot without a cold. You know, there's an opposite dynamic there, and you can't have a fast without a slow, and so on and so forth. Then it follows, at least it follows to me, that we cannot have a solid without a spirit. I don't know if you're following me there, but it would seem...
You're saying there must be an etheric underpinning.
Yeah.
Of all this. And,
yeah.
And that's what the ancients saw, that for the material world to emerge, it must have come from somewhere, and they began with the ether, and they saw that there were processes in the ether. And in some of these myths, like the story of how Zeus created the world, or how Atum, the ancient Egyptian god, created the universe, they are symbolizing these processes with the gods. The gods depict certain actions or processes, and as the myth proceeds, describing what they're doing, it's actually showing these processes, for example, mating, where you have in the case of the various Egyptian gods, the husband and wife mating would actually be processes intersecting symbolically.
Mm-hmm.
And then, for example, the birth of Geb and Nut, the separation of Geb and Nut, which symbolizes the separation of heaven and earth in Egyptian myth, would actually be the particle emerging into the physical world.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting.
Well, you're tying it in with, you know, you've got a very strong scientific background, right? I've been aware of you, and I've seen the work that you've been doing over the years as president of the organization. Your name pops up. If it doesn't pop up at least once a week, then there's something wrong. Paul, you've been in the who's who's of, what is it, the American...
the who's who of science and technology, I believe, the marquee.
So you know of what you're speaking of, and then you've gone out on the plank on this one here, in that
I understand it's a lot to buy, you know, especially in a short time interview, because it's so encompassing. There's so many facets, difficult to communicate.
Well, I don't know if it's so hard though, because I think its attitude comes in a lot, and we know that we've been taught. You know, that we must, you know, think like children, and we can understand things much clearer. And I've seen that in, you know, when I've had times when I've banged my head against a wall and I couldn't understand something and I couldn't understand it and so forth, I've just relaxed a little bit and I try to see it, you know, from another perspective. And I am foreign, but not to be gullible, but willing to learn. And I think you have so much in here that is of interest.
That's the beauty of these myths. They express the concept so simply and in metaphorical terms that you don't really have to be understand science to grasp the concepts.
Right, right. And then, you know, you have spent, an awful lot of time researching these ancient metaphors, these myths, and the way you tie them in, and the cultures that you've covered.
I wanted to wait, you know, before I made the announcement of this, because it was so important. See, I discovered back in 75. Now, maybe somebody else would have run out and started lecturing about it and tried to contact the media or something, but you have to, you know, for something this radical, you have to really do all your homework. And really to see the connection with the myths, it's based on a different science. And I had been in the process of developing that. It's called Subquantum Kinetics, and I have a technical book on that, which you've sold quite a few copies in the bookstore, which describes more for the scientist what it's about.
And right.
It's described in simpler terms than in this book, Beyond the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I wanted to get that anchor published. It's been published in referee journals. It's had very positive reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the predictions it made have checked out. Like, I was one of the first to disprove the Big Bang theory with observational data on the redshift. That was 9 years before Hubble telescope. Now, this was sort of an extension of this theory. I didn't, in my paper, say, well, this is an ancient science, you know. I never would have published a paper. But I wanted to get, it's sort of like the cement set for all of these ideas of this new perspective. One of the predictions was how when they did discover a brown dwarf, they'd find its mass and luminosity would be in a certain ratio, as predicted by this theory, and it checked out very well.
Time and again.
Yeah.
Paul, you know, some of the interesting things, and folks, I want you to get your pen and papers out. I've asked you to do that, and I want you to be able to get this book. Now, you can get the book by giving a call. This is the number. The number is 800-715-9993. That number again, 800-715-9993. The book is Beyond the Big Bang. It's by Dr. Paul LaViolette. And there's some important information that is described here because it ties together some of the, again, I don't know whether to say myth or not, but some of the things that, you know, we always found fascinating, people have told us about them, and of course we've had those people that have said, well, this here is all bunk and all that other stuff, but Paul, I think, brings it up to a point where there is some solid connection. There's a continuum that runs between what we have discovered to be fact and what these riddles are, if, for lack of a better word again. But you can get the book. It's available by calling 800-715-9993. But one of the other interesting things is the symbolic meaning of the Atlantis myth. Now, Paul, tie this one in because it really hit home with me.
Yeah, well, in the past, the tendency has been to take the myth of Atlantis literally. Now, this was related in Plato's Timaeus and Critias. In the Critias, his book of Critias, he speaks of the creation of Atlantis, how Neptune makes love with Pluto, and they create waves of land and ocean that form there's a central mountain with a ring of water and land and water and so on going out. And Plato actually gives the dimensions very accurately. Talks about life on Atlantis, and you have import and export of goods, boats coming in the harbor and taking goods and leaving. And now, the tendency has been to take this literally. People are going around looking for a place that has these moats and dikes. And this was not the intention. If you read carefully, the priest, Egyptian priest who was telling Solon, who was from ancient Greece visiting at Thais, was telling him this myth, said that their tradition was that these myths are metaphorical. And so you are led to believe that the myth of Atlantis was couched in metaphor. Now, you see, the ancient Egyptian priests couldn't disclose the knowledge they had directly. They were bound by secrecy to do this. You had to be part of their secret group to be able to be told directly what it all meant. But they were allowed to relate the myths and the metaphor projections which conveyed the science, because this is what the idea was. These were being handed down through time as a way to preserve the science. See, mm-hmm. You can put it in a form where people don't really understand what it is unless they can see it. You know what I mean? That they have the background to see the symbolism, and it just stands right out. That it's a way of preserving it from change. So if somebody else might say, well, I disagree with this point, if they didn't really understand the whole idea, and they might end up changing it, and before you know, the science is lost.
So it's going to bring a discipline into the myth or into the observation, so that it isn't easily changed, because if it's changed, there's a dramatic difference in outcome, something like that?
Right. And so what you find is that the story of Atlantis, I know this just to hear it for the first time, that people might find this very unusual to hear this interpretation, but you find that what they're really talking about, that Atlantis was really a creation myth.
Yeah.
And they weren't explaining the creation of the whole universe in one big swipe. They were dealing with the creation of a subatomic particle.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can explain one particle, you can explain, you repeat and you have other particles created. So
right.
They were trying to bite off a small piece, in effect. And that Atlantis, that little island, is really very little. It's really a subatomic particle. And
okay.
The wave, these motes and dikes, they really form a radial wave pattern.
Okay.
In two dimensions, in effect. And if you were to model these equations, you have developed equations of this reaction diffusion system, as they call it. It's a version of the Brusselator, which work on this has been done by Prigogine's group. He was awarded Nobel Prize. You may have heard of him.
Yeah.
And I modified his reaction system for application to physics. And if you say that those reactions, instead of being chemical reactions, they're etheric reactions, and that instead of the concentrations being chemical concentrations, they're really etheric concentrations or energy, potential energy waves, you might say,
mm-hmm.
You find that they generate, you simulate this on the computer, and you find they generate spontaneously wave patterns. And if you model this in two dimensions, you get a wave pattern that looks just like what Plato designed there. In fact, the wavelength increases as you go out, just as Plato was describing the distances between the motes and dikes increases as you go out.
Mm-hmm.
So, first of all, to conceive that matter is basically wave in nature is a major intellectual achievement, just that.
Yeah.
And you find it not only in the Atlantis myth, you see it in the Tarot, in the yin-yang metaphysics of the Chinese, and other places, even astrology,
mm-hmm.
you see that. And let alone to say, not only is it a wave, but to describe how this wave emerges using concepts that we've just discovered, nonlinear systems. I mean, they're so complex that you can't just go to the blackboard like you picture a physicist going to the blackboard and solving the equation. You need a computer. So to have knowledge of this, you wonder, did they have access to computers to really understand the systems like we do?
Well, that's very fascinating, because time and again, we find that something that the ancients have done, we call it, incalculable. We can't match that technology. When we look at the placement of some of these large stones, the biggest cranes on Earth couldn't budge them. I mean, they would just be worthless in order to handle them. But yet, the ancients, in some form or another, were able to move great objects, as well as, I'm sure they were trying to pass on some information to us. We're going to have more of Beyond the Big Bang with Dr. Paul LaViolette in the second half of the Extraordinary Science Radio Show. J.W. McGinnis here. Want to remind you, this is the Extraordinary Science Radio Hour, and if you want a free information packet about the Tesla Society, just give us a call. Leave your name clearly on the tape if you get the tape. And that number is 800-397-0137. if you've got a tricky name in your street or in your own name, please spell it clearly. No need to call back. We do get them out right away, and before you know it, you can be a member of the most exciting scientific organization in the world, the International Tesla Society. All right. We're ready for a break now. I want you to keep your seatbelts fastened, and we're going to be back with more of Dr. Paul LaViolette and Beyond the Big Bang. So stay tight. We'll be back.